Agnes Nixon is a writer whose words have touched millions and millions of Americans. She writes soap operas. Nixon started with radio. By 1951, she'd created her first TV soap. More than 40 years ago, she launched One Life to Live and All My Children, and at 83, she's still going. Last summer, Nixon won a Lifetime Achievement Emmy, which was presented by the pivotal character in All My Children, the actress Susan Lucci, who plays the much-married, lovely, evil Erica.
I would not be who I am today, I would not even be here today, if Agnes had not created the feisty Erica Kane.
The award cites Nixon for writing social issues into soaps, AIDS, abortion, racism, interracial relationships, and same-sex marriage. Nixon says soaps were a cultural joke, and she wanted to be serious. She started with cancer, and one of the most loved characters in the soaps, Burt Bauer of Guiding Light.
The first thing I ever did was the pap smear test, getting women aware that uterine cancer could be cured if caught in time. And we did start the trend of doing social issues. I wasn't trying to change the genre. I was just trying to write what I thought, what was interesting to me. And I guess it's called being a writer.
The cancer decision, that came out of a personal friendship.
Yes. A friend died at 40. But I did some research on the subject of cancer and found that uterine cancer is curable if caught in time. So I suggested it to Procter & Gamble, who owned the show, and to CBS, on which it was seen. And they said, oh, no, that's an educational program. We're doing an entertainment program. So I wrote out how it would be integrated into the story, and CBS and Procter & Gamble said, well, all right, do it, but don't say uterus, don't say cancer, and don't say hysterectomy. And I thought, well, that's a little tough. So I wrote scenes when the doctor would tell Bert that she had what we called irregular cells rather than possible cancer. And so it was very successful, and that hooked me. That made me realize, gee, we could do something.
Was that the worst pushback you ever had? Did you feel at some point that you kind of hit a limit and people just were not willing to let you do what you wanted?
The most difficult thing, the thing that really shocked me, I had on The Guiding Light, a main character was in the hospital and a nurse was an African-American, and they became friends. And so I had, after the patient went home, the nurse in street clothes came to visit her and dared to use the front door. And a store in the South canceled Procter & Gamble products because of this, and I was severely criticized. And they said, you just can't do something like that. A year later, One Life went on, and the main story was one that forced the audience, hopefully, to examine their prejudices, because Carla Gray was the character's name, and she was an African-American of very light pigmentation, and for 5 months the audience thought she was white. And she was engaged to a white doctor, then became a patient in the hospital and fell in love with a black resident. And I have got a letter from a man in Seattle that said, I want to protest that white girl kissing that black resident. And then he went on, he said, but I'm getting confused. If she turns out to be black, I want to protest her kissing the white doctor.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, really. But that was the most difficult thing. But ABC said, I said, may I do the stories? I really feel important. And they said, do them.
You must have written thousands and thousands of pages of dialogue, oceans of conversations. Did you think of them as real when you were doing it?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I have a little studio on the third floor in my house, and I'd go up there, and I have what we call the ugly chair. It's very comfortable, but it's very ugly. And I would sit there and sort of empty my mind, and then I'd hear them talking.
We talked to Nixon in her New York apartment, in a room bathed in the pinkish light of silk lampshades, with her Emmy sitting on the windowsill. She's a tiny woman, very pretty, very delicate-looking, but when we went with her to the studios where One Life to Live was being shot, it was clear she is a very important person.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have God here. Look good. Oh, my God. The goddess is here.
Work stopped, and the cast and crew crowded around Agnes Nixon. We stayed when they went back to the drama unfolding, a gritty story of booze and bar fights, part of Nixon's legacy.
In 5 seconds, 4, 3, 2.
You know, for the record, back there at the bar before you started your little otter story, I had things under control. I had it handled.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Meanwhile, Agnes Nixon was quizzing the producer about how to work the bad economy into scripts. In our conversation about soaps over the last 40 years, I asked her if there was anything left that she thought her audiences should confront. And she mentioned Erica Kane's daughter, Bianca, on All My Children.
I think the last holdout was homosexuality. When we did Bianca and made the audience love her and respect her, we knew we had to make the lesbian a daughter of a popular character. And, of course, we let the audience know first before Erica did. So everybody was waiting to see how Erica would react. And that character, Bianca, became the most popular woman on daytime. I felt that was the last thing that I could think of. If you can think of something else, send me a postcard.
Agnes Nixon, on her long career as the creator and writer of many soap operas. We visited her in New York City. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Stephen Skiff.
Finally today, I have a few words about a guilty pleasure. This is the time of year when many of us find ourselves indulging in things that we can easily resist the rest of the year that probably aren't that good for us. But what the heck? It's the holidays, so we do it anyway. My guilty pleasure right now is a show on NBC called The Sing-Off. The whole series is only 5 episodes, and the live finale is tonight. The Sing-Off is one of those competition shows, what we used to call a talent show, and it involves 10 a cappella singing groups competing for money and a record contract. And they're real groups, which is to say they were all doing their thing before a show existed to show them off. The 10 contenders included groups like the Whiff and Poofs from Yale University, a venerable men's group whose members still perform in white tie and tails, although members of the group are not, surprise, surprise, as white as they were back in the day. As well, there's an old-school black men's doo-wop group called Jerry Lawson and the Talk of the Town. That's the kind of group that sings the music your parents and their friends would hand-dance to while you watch from the stairs rolling your eyes. And, of course, there is the young multicultural hotness. Not quite Twilight hot, but hot nonetheless. From places like the Berklee College of Music in Boston, the University of Oregon, and even a high school group from Ohio. Can I just tell you, nobody is more surprised than I am that I'm hooked on this thing. You're listening to a person who didn't even own a television until they started covering national politics, and it got to be too embarrassing to keep asking to go over a friend's house to watch the debates. This wasn't some ideological thing either. It's just that TVs were expensive when I was growing up, and ours kept getting stolen. So finally, my parents just gave up, and I grew out of the habit. Then, for a while, when I worked in TV, I thought I had to watch it, kind of like professional courtesy, I suppose. But now I have to say that between kids with homework and all the reading I have to do, very little other than sports and news captures my attention. Once I interviewed a very accomplished stage and film actor whose own brother was starring in a hit TV show, and that actor told me he didn't watch TV. I thought he was lying. But now I believe him, because really, why? How many crazy crimes or gory surgeries can you really watch? As for the ever-growing number of competition shows, I think I know why many people are put off by them. Sometimes it feels like the kids who were bullies in high school are all grown up and bullying people some more, only getting paid to do it. Like I said, why? So why do I like this show? First of all, because it's got wonderful singing, which I revere, in part because I cannot sing. People say if you can talk, you can sing. But those people only say that because they've never heard me sing. Second, I like it because it's about what it says it's about, which is the quality of the performance. It's not about hair or clothes or picking on people who can't fight back or people acting out some desperate need for attention that can never actually be fulfilled. The judges, who can all themselves write or sing music, actually help you understand what a strong performance is. And yes, the diversity, different styles of music from different eras performed by people who, yes, I'll say it, actually look like America. They come from all kinds of places, big cities and small towns, and they look like they eat every day, get their hair cut at the mall, and pick their own clothes. I don't know how the cult of celebrity started in this country where people have been led to believe you are nothing and nobody if you're not famous. And fame, not skill or accomplishment, is the end in itself. I think that's why I'm hooked on this show, because people getting praise for doing something lovely and doing it well, imagine that. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Now let's turn to the holidays and everybody's favorite part of them, the meals. We were looking around our office and realizing that many folks will be sitting down to holiday meals, and they already have, with relatives and friends who may be from very different cultural backgrounds. So instead of turkey and mashed potatoes, they might be used to tucking into homemade pasta, maybe tamales, maybe sauerkraut and pigtails. And all that variety could make for a very nice multicultural mix, or maybe a big fat mess. So we wanted to ask, what is the answer to keeping everybody at the table happy over the holiday season? And who better to school us on meals for culturally diverse families than Chef Kevin Spraga? He's the latest winner of the hit show Top Chef DC. That's on the Bravo network. He is also a member of a multicultural family, and he's with us once again. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now, Kevin, you were telling us when we last spoke after your big win on Top Chef, congratulations once again.
Thank you.
That your mom is Italian-American and your dad is African-American, so you grew up with a mix. Did they have to do any negotiating around holiday meals?
Well, both of my parents were separated, and what was interesting is we would have an Italian-American meal earlier in the day and then an African-American meal later in the day.
Well, that doesn't work for everybody, and everybody might not want to have two different meals. So what would you recommend? Just put everything on the table that everybody wants to eat, or do you think that there is a better way to maybe make it a little bit more coherent?
Well, first, there's no pleasing everyone. All you can do is try your best. Second is to put as much out there as possible. Put a little bit of pasta. Put a little collard greens out there. Put some rice and beans out there. I mean, my wife comes from a Hispanic background. They're from Puerto Rico. And when I cook, we have a little bit of everything.
Well, let's say the table space is limited, let's say that finances are a little limited and you don't feel you can afford to do everything that everybody might like to see. What do you think is the best way to go about deciding what's really important and what isn't?
Well, I think there's always a few standout dishes. For me, with my mom, it was her salad. Very, very simple, but, olive oil and vinegar, and that was great. So that, for me, had to be on there. And maybe a pasta dish. And, with my dad and his background, the starches and the vegetables, whether it was the cabbage or the collard greens or the mac and cheese. So I felt like that needed to be there. And then we have my wife's component, and they do a roast pork at Christmas time called pernil, and that has to be there. That's a must. I mean, that thing is amazing. So I guess basically what you have to do is pick and choose your favorites.
Do you ever alternate? Do you ever say, okay, roast pork this year and then next year something else?
Absolutely. We've done that multiple times. Even the way that we prepare turkey at, let's say Thanksgiving is different. There's a more traditional American way, and then the way her family does it is completely different. And when we have it at home, we've flipped and flopped, and one year we had it one way, and one year we had it the next. I mean, it's how we worked it out.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about preparing a multicultural holiday meal that pleases everybody, or at least as most people as you can please, as Chef Kevin Spraga tells us, you cannot please everybody. He is season 7 winner of the reality show contest, Top Chef DC on the Bravo network. And he's telling us how to put together a multicultural meal that can please just about everybody. So now you've whetted my appetite, as you would imagine. What are the two different turkey preparations that you were telling us about? There's a traditional turkey recipe that I think a lot of us know. What's the one that you're saying that that your wife's side of the family, who's from Puerto Rico, prepares that you have to have sometimes. And throw that roast pork in there, too, while you're at it.
Absolutely. So my mother-in-law, Loida, she takes the turkey and she pokes holes in it with a knife. And she studs it or stuffs it with little pieces of garlic and little pieces of salt pork. So the turkey breast picks up that saltiness and that porkiness and the garlic. And she cooks it in the oven bag and slowly cooks it for probably about 6 hours altogether. So when the turkey comes out, it doesn't come out whole and beautiful like you would expect. It comes out more like shredded meat. A lot of times there's something called confit in French, which is slowly poached in its own fat. You do that with pork or duck. So it kind of takes on that pulled pork or pulled meat type of resemblance, but it's absolutely amazing. And then, of course, you have the traditional turkey that's just kind of roasted in the oven, and maybe you brine it before or marinate it before. And then there's the roast pork. And they marinate that in something called sofrito. And not everyone does it, but, you know, some of them do. And sofrito is like garlic and herbs and peppers all rubbed in there. Then they season that and then slowly roast that until that's falling apart as well.
That sounds really good. Now, what sides do you feel are a must? What has to be on your table?
There's got to be yams. That's a must. That's like the first thing that has to be there. The second thing is mac and cheese. I think that's a must for me. Third is some type of stuffing. I enjoy a pasta salad or a potato salad or just a regular salad. I think that kind of cleanses the palate, and that needs to be there as well. You know, there could be rice and beans. There could be the collard greens, the cabbage. Also, there has to be cranberry sauce, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas. I need cranberry sauce.
Okay, that sounds very everyman. And here you are. You're a trained chef. You've been to culinary school. And you're mm-hmm. still eating the food that all of us eat. I'm kind of intrigued by that. You don't ever try to show off and throw some, I don't know, you just threw the confit thing in there for me. But you throw anything in there to show off?
Showing off is for work. That's not for home. Home is, you know, I know how to turn the chef on and off in me. And when I'm at home, I like to enjoy the family and enjoy other people's cooking and just be a regular person and enjoy the food and the company. When I'm at work, that's when I turn the fanciness on.
Okay, let's look ahead to New Year's Day. That there are mm-hmm. certain dishes that a lot of people are used to having. I know for in the African American tradition, the black eyed peas have to be there. The collard greens have to be there. For a lot of people, pig's feet. But some people, it's chitlins. But I'm sorry, that's a step too far for some of us.
Yeah, I can't do it.
Can't go. You can't do it either. Thank you.
No.
But New Year's Day, looking ahead, what do you think has to be there?
The black eyed peas. That's, you know, as soon as you said that, I was thinking of my dad. And honestly, he's the only one that eats them, but they have to be there every year. You know, it's just part of it. It has to be there.
So what's your word of wisdom for kind of bringing the traditions together?
Enjoy it. Embrace it. There's no set rules, especially nowadays. So many people are multicultural. Sit down, enjoy the food. Yeah, it's not like mom or maybe it's not like dad, but sit down and enjoy it. Embrace it. Embrace the other cultures and just have a good time with it.
Top Chef Kevin Sprague is the winner of the latest season of the reality show Top Chef DC on the Bravo Network. He was kind enough to join us from Philadelphia. Thank you so much and happy holidays to you.
Thank you, and you as well.
The movie It's a Wonderful Life was released in 1946, and it still gets a wondrous amount of airtime around the holidays. But a museum dedicated to the movie's star is not living such a wonderful life. Here's more from Larkin Page Jacobs of member station WDUQ.
James Maitland Stewart grew up in Indiana, Pennsylvania, about an hour east of Pittsburgh. He's the town's favorite son, and he even tells you when to cross the street.
This is Jimmy Stewart. Our Philadelphia Street walk sign is on to cross Philadelphia Street. 11.
Just as Bailey Building and Loan fought to keep its doors open in the movie, the Jimmy Stewart Museum is trying to stay afloat. The museum is housed in the third story of a library where volunteer Pat Ward greets visitors.
And away in a corner, a replica of his boyhood bedroom, but with the original elongated bed because he was so tall. But let's get started right over here.
Stewart called the people who paid to see his movies his partners. And museum director Tim Harley says that generation of fans is fading, as evidenced by the slip in attendance. In 2000, it peaked at 10,000 visitors. This year, the museum will be lucky to get 5,000. The bus tours for seniors that once comprised a big share of gate receipts has dropped off, and so has funding from the state of Pennsylvania. Harley says what they really need is an endowment to make sure the roughly $150,000 they use to operate will always be there.
We're accustomed to living frugally. We have a very small operation. Nonetheless, it's one that's very well received.
John Butzo is president of the museum's board and sees the organization as a last stand between Stewart and the disappearance of his legacy. He says with the exception of It's a Wonderful Life, Stewart's movies aren't being shown much anymore.
We don't want that to fade. And we want to be sure that people have some real heroes to think about. He certainly was one.
If this were Bedford Falls and It's a Wonderful Life, the museum would get a bailout.
Quiet, everybody. Quiet, quiet. Now get this. It's from London.
Oh.
Mr. Gower cabled you need cash. Stop. My office instructed to advance you up to $25,000. Stop. Oh. Hee-haw and Merry Christmas, Sam Wainwright.
But this isn't Bedford Falls, and Butzo's worried about what will happen 6 months from now since the locals aren't in a position to help. 2.5 hours after the museum opens, the first visitor of the day has yet to walk through the door. Finally, Kathy DeCaria and her husband arrive. She says it's family tradition to decorate the tree while watching the movie.
Me, I'm an old movie nut anyways, and there's something about Jimmy Stewart. And the thought of losing this museum is sad. It's sad. So we made a special trip.
The DeCarias are disappointed his movies haven't caught on with younger generations.
We've become all Potters. Okay, Mr. Potters. We're losing the George Baileys. Okay?
Right.
George Bailey gave up his dreams to run the family business and fight off a town takeover by the slumlord Henry Potter. The museum hopes the goodwill engendered by Stewart's characters and Stewart himself will give it the financial staying power to keep him from fading away. For NPR News, I'm Larkin Page Jacobs.